In our prayer with Wally, we ask God to bless us that we might be better in our service as a result of our being here tonight. That's exactly why we are going to engage in the study that we're engaged in. We just sang, "Holy, holy, holy, this God is." By tripling the word like that, we're saying He is utmost holy. He's the most holy being that exists. And He is worthy of our very best service. So hopefully our study tonight will better equip us to serve this mighty God who sent His Son to redeem us from sin. A mother is preparing breakfast. And she tells her teenage son to go to the store. He says, "Why?" She says, "I'm out of bread." What does she mean by bread?
A loaf of bread.
Loaf of bread, food, right? Something made out of flour, food that you make a sandwich with. Two men are gambling. One guy keeps losing, but he keeps playing. Finally, the other guy says, "Fella, this is enough. I want you to pay up right now." He says, "I'm out of bread." What does he mean?
He's out of money.
Out of money. Same word, but a different meaning. So on your lesson, you see that first point. You've heard me talk about it 100 times. But that's the point right there. Words are vehicles upon which thoughts, sometimes multiple thoughts, travel. Here the vehicle was bread. One time it meant something you eat. One time it meant money. And you can verify this fact by just looking in a dictionary at a word. And I don't know, you'd probably be hard-pressed to find a word that only has one definition. Some will have 2, 3, 5 or more. And what that's telling you is different passengers are on the bus oftentimes. So what happens that changes meanings of words sometimes is age. A word was used one way in years past. But in time, history, usage, it changes meanings. And we can discover that change in meaning when we go back and look at the history of that word. We'll be talking about some of that tonight. Another thing that alters the meaning of a particular word is who uses it in what circumstance. We just illustrated that. A mother fixing breakfast or two fellows that are gambling. One's a matter of providing a lunch and one is providing payment for a debt. And so different people in different circumstances may use the same word with different meanings. That's just a fact of our language, and we need to be aware of that. Now, the word communication, as you know, comes from the word common. And so if I'm going to communicate for the person who I am communicating with to understand what I mean, what I meant by the word must be common between us. I can't use the word with one meaning and the other person understand that I'm using another meaning. There's no communication. We've talked, but there's no communication. And so that's going to be a fundamental concept in our study tonight. Now, we have here on your lesson some exhortations regarding our speech. So look at Proverbs 10, 31 and 32. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 31 and 32. Does everybody have a copy of the sheet for tonight? There's not a whole lot on it, but I can get you a copy if you want it. Anybody need a copy? Okay. Anybody else? Makes good scratch paper. Okay, Proverbs 31 and 32. Chapter 10, verse 31 and 32. The mouth of the righteous flows with wisdom, but a perverted tongue will be cut out. The lips of the righteous bring forth what is acceptable, the mouth of the wicked, what is perverted. So here's a warning about our speech, that we're careful in what we say. Then in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 29, here you have an admonition to the Christians in Ephesus relative to their speech. Let no unwholesome word proceed out of your mouth, but such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. So here are people that came out of the world, no telling what kind of language they used, and they're exhorted to think about the words they say and whether or not they are in accord with the confession they've made of Christ as their King. Over in Matthew chapter 12, really the context over here in Matthew 12 is blaspheming the Holy Spirit. These religious leaders and their refusal to accept Jesus attributed the work that He did to Beelzebub, Jesus warns them in Matthew 12, 33 through 37 about their speech. And I want to just drop down to 36. I tell you that every careless word that people speak, they shall give an accounting for in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. I say that because we need to be careful of the words we speak. Number one, that they do not connote something that is harmful, that is immoral, that is ungodly. But on the other hand, there's another side to that. We need to be careful that we don't charge people with using words that are immoral or ungodly, when in fact they didn't mean that by the word. When we do that, we're misusing our tongue. So there's a two-sided thing to this that we want to see tonight, and you'll see that as we go through our study. We're going to look at etymology for a little while. Etymology simply has to do with the origin and history and development of words. And so that has a tremendous bearing on word meaning. So we put on your sheet the word goodbye. And the email that we mailed out was said that there might be a time when an atheist might not tell you goodbye. And here's the reason. This word has as its root sentiment, God be with you. Now when? Last year? No, in the 900s. God be with you. So would an atheist say, God be with you, goodbye? No. The later was rather, that phrase was contracted into several one words, but in different languages, and finally the end result is our word, goodbye. And all it means today is a farewell. You're leaving my presence. Goodbye. Has nothing to do with God. An atheist might say it to you, not connoting any idea that he's inciting or calling for God's blessings upon you. And so, here's a word that in its history shows the change of meaning of that word. And it's a word that people who did not believe in God would not have used in years past. We used the word candidate in our email. We pointed out that if you lived in ancient Rome, you could know who was a candidate running for office without them saying a word. And here's how. Our word candidate had its root back in that period. And back then it meant white garment. Those running for public offices would wear white garments. Something like, I don't know if they had put chalk on them or just that color or what. You can go look it up for yourself. And so if you're walking in the forum there in Rome and here's a guy in a white garment, you say, oh, he's running for public office. That's where the word candidate comes from. Now, in the election that we had in November, could you identify a candidate by white garments? No. And these white garments, they think, was probably supposed to say how innocent and pure they were. Good guy to vote for. Well, you sure wouldn't apply today, would it? But here's a word that has changed meaning over time and really has nothing to do with the way it was used back in ancient Rome. That's simply the nature of etymology. Now, what's true of our language, and there are many, many examples of this, this is also true with Bible words. And so we ask you in the email, is it wrong to debate? So in the King James Version, who has the King James Version tonight? Only Sally, I bet. All right, Sally, you've got the King James Version. Read Romans 1:29, the King James Version.
Being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate.
Whoa, wait, what'd you say? Debate? Is that what it says?
That's what it says.
Debate's unrighteous. That's what the text says. Have you ever encouraged people to debate their position? Let's debate our views religiously. Have you ever wanted political opponents to debate? Have you been encouraging sin? That verse in 1611, and that particular King James Version is probably the 1779 edition, was a word that describes a sinful act. Now, if you're reading the other version, major version, the New American Standard or the New King James or the English Standard, instead of debate, what does it have? Strife. So, that's what it meant when that version was translated. You study with people. Maybe here's somebody that doesn't know anything about the Bible. Oftentimes, what they're going to have is a King James Version. Not that they can't use it, but just be aware. You need to be aware as a teacher. It's no telling what kind of words that they're going to read might confuse them. It's a good version. It's just antiquated. And so here's a classic example. Here's a word that completely changed meaning. Today, the word debate simply means to argue your position, to present reasons in defense of what you believe. debate's a good word. Paul debated. Jesus debated. And it's a good word. But when that version was translated, you can see it had a different connotation. Or in other words, here's the debate bus. See, we got the bus. Right on the side is written debate. Now, you send that, you got a thought in your mind, you send it to somebody. I want to debate you. They get their Bible out and read their Bible, King James Version. They want to have strife. They want to fight. What happened? Wrong passenger got off the bus. The one that got off the bus, he had old white hair. He was old and crippled. He lived back in 1779, see? But that's a passenger on the bus. It was at one time. And so this shows the value of comparing translations. Now, I'm not saying the King James is a bad translation. I use it in my study, and it's sometimes very good. Just be aware of the fact that words change meanings. Okay, Sean, would you go to the front and touch on that slide, please, sir? Turn to Psalm 83:13. Psalm 88:13. Did you touch it? Okay, just stay right there. That's good. Just leave it down. Just stay right there. All right, Psalm 88:13. Look at this. It says, "In the morning my prayer shall present thee." That's the King James Version. Your prayer is going to prevent God from doing something. You got some powerful prayers, huh? What does your version, as you're reading, say?
My prayer has come before you.
Come before you. Go before you. Here's a word, prevent, that as it was translated in the King James Version, that has changed meaning. And so the etymology, the history, origin of that word shows you that. And it doesn't mean what it meant then. So if you're studying with somebody and they read that version, they, first of all, will probably not understand it. If they make an argument from it, they won't understand it. But you know that there's people in religion today say that's the only version you ought to use is the King James Version. That's a mistake. It's a good version, but realize that. All right, Psalm 119:147. Look at your version. Psalm 119:147. I rise before the dawn and cry for help. I wait for your words. Look what this version says. Now you talk about some powerful prayer. You want to sleep late? I prevented the dawn of the morning. Isn't that interesting? I prevented the dawning of the morning. That was one powerful prayer, wasn't it? Instead of dawning at 7 o'clock, it dawned at 10 o'clock so you could sleep late. Prevent. That's the word that was used. Good translation when it was made. It just changed meaning. One time, meant to hinder. Now it means to go before. I went before you in the early hours of the morning. 1 Thessalonians 4:15. So those that are alive when Christ comes shall not prevent those who are asleep. King James Version. Shall not go before those who are asleep. So here are some illustrations of what we talked about with using words in our language. But it's also true with Bible words. And so just be aware of that. Okay. Now, open your Bibles to Ephesians 5:19. We're all familiar with this text. And my guess is I'd be 100% correct if I said everybody's Bible that's here tonight reads something like this. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. Is that correct? Does that say anything about instrumental music? Oh, but it does. According to the Amplified Bible Classic Edition. You ever heard of the Amplified Bible? It's a version. And what they did was try to amplify, that is, put meaning for words in the text to help the reader. Now, I've got a copy on my shelf. I used to have that classic edition. I don't know what happened to it. But I've got a copy that reads different. They've changed it. But in the classic edition, good thing I remembered. Boy, don't I have a great memory. But anyway, good thing I remembered. And in the classic edition, here's how it reads. Speak out to one another in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, offering praise with voices, and instruments. That's in brackets, but it's there. And instruments. And making melody with your heart to the Lord. So people go out to the bookstore and they buy a Bible. Well, boy, this one reads easy. I'll get this one. the Amplified Bible. And so they read that. So if they're talking to you, what are you going to say? I don't know what to say except that's a terrible version. Well, why is it? Why is yours better? Well, what's the deal? Okay, now, in debate, you know, between two preachers, debating the right of using instrumental music, this verse has been used. And the word that's translated, making melody, has been used to say that this verse authorizes instrumental music. So it's not just a version, it's been done in debate. And they say that Thayer, you know who Thayer is, the Greek lexicon, Grimm Thayer Greek lexicon, widely known, we refer to it all the time, verifies that that word meant, you'll notice on the sheet I set out, I didn't say means, I say meant. Meant singing to the accompaniment of a stringed instrument or something like that. Okay, Sean, touch that screen. Okay. Now, here is a definition that TH on the bottom stands for Thayer. Okay? So, here's that Greek word up at the top, that number up there. If you ever do Bible research, you know that Mr. Strong, thanks to Mr. Strong, he's put numbers by the Hebrew and Greek words to help people like me that don't know Hebrew and Greek to understand which word it is. So that's 5567. That's the number he gave that word. With an H in front of it if you see it oftentimes in a book. Hebrew. And then those other letters right there, that's Greek letters for the word P-S-A-L-L-O. Okay? Solo. Now, look at the definitions. Did we say that dictionaries have different definitions? That's what a lexicon is. A lexicon is a dictionary. But it's a dictionary of ancient words and how they were used. How do they get those definitions? They have to go back and find documents where those words were used, maybe a letter or an official document or a book or something. And this is an amazing concept. They define the words by context, how they're used. And so when they write their dictionary, lexicon, they tell you this word was used this way or this way or this way or this way. Now here's the danger of using a Strong's. He may give you some of those definitions, but he doesn't tell you when it was used that way. And you may find a strong concordance with the definitions in the back that tells you this word means to sing to the accompaniment of an instrument or something like that, or other lexicons. A more comprehensive lexicon like Thayer, like what I'll show you what he does here, he puts some notations in there. And you'll see that on that first definition, he's got that fella, A-E-S-C-H-Y-L-U-S. And what he's telling you is that it was used that way when that man lived. Now look at the bottom of the chart. That fellow lived 500 years before Christ. That's the way it was used then. Okay, now look at the second definition. To cause, to vibrate by touching, to twang. Well, when was that used? You see that guy Euripides? Well, see, we're down at the bottom chart when he lived, 450 years before Christ. That's the way it was used then. So, now that first definition, I didn't put all of Thayer there, but if that's, we want to take that definition and use it today, Keith couldn't do it. Because it was to pull or pluck out the hair. But, 50 years later, you see this other guy using it in a different sense. That is, to touch or strike the cork, to twang the strings of a musical instrument so that they vibrate. Well, that's the third one down, Aristotle. The second one was the cause to vibrate by touching, and then they applied it to an instrument. And that's Aristotle, and you see when he lived, 350 B.C. Okay? And then you have the next definition. Now he says the Septuagint. Now you see on the bottom of the chart we have Septuagint. That's about 200, 250 years before Christ. This is the common version of people in the first century, the Septuagint version. It's a translation from Hebrew to Greek. And here's what Mr. Thayer says. To sing to the music of a harp in the Septuagint. To sing to the music of a harp. So if I'm debating this, you say, no, we can't use instrumental music. I say, you believe in a lexicon? Well, yeah, they're authoritative on word meanings. Here's a lexicon right here that says this word meant to sing to the music of a harp, or if you expand it with stringed instruments. Well, what are you going to say? Remember that bus? They got different pastors on that bus. It did mean that one time. But what these debaters won't tell you is what's at the bottom of Mr. Thayer's definition. I've got it capitalized. He doesn't in his lexicon. I put it capitalized here. In the New Testament. Now, that's not a gospel preacher saying that. That's a lexicographer. A well-known lexicographer. He said, in the New Testament, to sing a hymn, to celebrate the praises of God in song. And he has the five times that word occurs. So you got James 5, Ephesians 5, Romans 15, and twice in Romans 14, 15. The five times, he says it means to sing a song. Vocal music. So that word and time changed its meaning. You can see that. Just like the word goodbye. See, just like the word candidate. Just like the word prevent. And so it is with this word. And so, there's a way to check these lexicons. I don't know much about a lexicon. God in His grace, and while He talked about God and is providing things for us to help us, we live in a time, we're blessed. You say, okay, I tell you what, I don't know anything about Greek or Hebrew. I'd like to go to somebody who does know something about it. Well, there's Mr. Thayer, we got his. But I'd feel better if we had a panel of men, maybe 10 men or 15 men, know Greek and Hebrew, and see if they agree. What if we could assemble a panel of, say, 100 men of different religious backgrounds? Not once, not twice, maybe five times, different men, different religious backgrounds. Say, what does that word mean? You've got it. Touch the chart, Sean. Okay, that's it. Thank you, sir. So, King James Version, 1611, 1779. Quite a ways from 250 B.C., right? New King James Version, American Standard Version, Revised Standard Version, New American Standard Version, English Standard Version. All your major versions translate that word, sing, making melody or sing. None of them talk about using instruments. So that's deceptive. It's deceptive in that translation, the Amplified Bible. They're sticking a definition in there that's out of date. It'd be like going to those verses in Psalms and saying, now, if you want to prevent the dawning and get up late, here, that word means prevent. And so the same thing is true here. So this can help us in our service to God to understand word meanings and their etymology and the importance of understanding that, not only for ourselves, but should we have opportunity to talk to others about the gospel of Christ. All right. Now, forget about that. We're through with that. All right, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about euphemisms. What is a euphemism? It's a mild or indirect or vague term for one that's considered harsh or blunt or offensive. Are there euphemisms in the Bible? There are. Turn to John chapter 11. John chapter 11. Verse 11. Talking about Lazarus. Remember Lazarus had died? Jesus purposely waited 4 days when he was told he was sick. He died. So verse 11. He said, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go that I may awaken him out of sleep. Here's the bus. Sleep. Right there on the side. Sleep. So the disciples, passenger gets off the bus and says verse 12, well, if he's falling asleep, he'll recover. He'll recover. He'll wake up. What's the big deal? That's the passenger that got off the bus. Just taking rest. And now note, Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he was speaking of literal sleep. We often talk about figurative versus literal. Well, Jesus wasn't speaking literally. He's speaking figuratively. And that's one of the meanings of sleep. We use it today. And so, Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. By the way, when you're defining figurative language, it's a good verse. It's other than the plainest way to say something. That's what figurative language is. But here's the case of he used something that's not as hard and blunt. He's asleep. We say he passed away or... if it's a Christian, we say he's asleep in Jesus or something like that. It's just a milder way of saying something. That's a euphemism. That's what euphemisms are. So we find them in the Bible. Jesus himself were using them. But as you can see with this passage, what we opened up talking about is a danger. One, there was no communication between Jesus and the disciples. Jesus talked to them, but there was no communication. Because what Jesus had in his mind when he said sleep was not common with what was in their mind when they heard sleep. Now, so that resulted in misunderstanding. Now, they say, well, he's going to wake up. Suppose that it went away and said, you know, Jesus, I used to think a lot of him, but he was totally mistaken. He thought Lazarus was just taking a nap. What would that have been? What would they have been guilty of? Misrepresenting Jesus, right? We can be guilty of that. Because we don't understand the euphemism and how it was used, or a word and how it was used. A word sometimes that has changed meaning over time, as the illustrations we gave, or a word that is different in a different setting in a different culture. The very first illustration we used with the word bread. It's different with a mother fixing a lunch and two guys who are gambling and one guy got a big debt. The settings and the people involved can make a difference in how a word is used. Okay? So, look at John 7:24. Jesus is talking about how they were judging him. They saw things, heard him say things, they misunderstood. Here's his admonition. Do not judge according to your appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. They were trying to say, violate the Sabbath day. Heal the man on the Sabbath day. Do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. And so if we hear somebody use a word and we think, well, that's not right. We better be careful we understand what they meant by it. How they were using it. We may think it's immoral or ungodly or false something, but we better understand before we make charges about that person and what they're guilty of. I'm not going to have time to read Exodus chapter 23 and Job 19, but Exodus 23 is a warning about false charges. And don't follow a crowd just because 10 other people say it. Don't say the same thing. And Job 19, that was one of his problems with his so-called friends. They made all kinds of charges against him. Three guys against one. And they made charges against you that is not true what you say. So be careful of just joining in someone who accuses somebody of saying something that's ungodly or evil or immoral when there may not be any foundation to it. Romans 12:17, here's the other side of that. Look at Romans chapter 12, verse 17. The end of the verse, second part of the verse. Respect what is right in the sight of men. I put 2 Corinthians 8:21 as well, where Paul was talking about carrying this money. And he talked about the fact of having agents. He could have done it, but he wanted something that was honorable and above board where nobody would question it. So there's sometimes things you do simply for the fact that you don't want to leave the wrong impression if you can avoid it. Sometimes you can't avoid people mischarging you. They mischarge Jesus. They mischarge Paul. Paul was accused falsely for his second letter to the Corinthians. Or it's not going there twice. You can't avoid that totally. But even back in the Old Testament, when they carried the money from their captivity back to their homeland, you remember it was counted before they left, it counted when they got there. You try to do things that are right in the sight of the society in which you live. And so because words can have different meaning doesn't mean we ought to use every word that may be legitimate in a particular setting, but it may not fit in the company you're keeping. In the society you're maintaining, in the friends that you have, it may leave a wrong connotation altogether that you never intended. So what do? Respect what is right in the sight of man. Do what is honorable. And so that can govern our choices in our speech and these words that we have here on your lesson. Look, we have here this term cursing or profanity. And I don't remember if I put that on your lesson or not. Let's see. Yes, I did. Cursing, profanity. And so we use the term cussing. Cussing, cursing. Curse was to invoke a judgment on somebody that you wish that they go to hell, that kind of thing. And it was an ugly word. It was a word of hatred and vindictiveness. That's the idea of cursing. We've shortened that to cuss and made it very light. But anyway, that's the idea. And so That kind of speech is often called profanity. It's harsh. It's not characteristic of those who love their neighbor. And sometimes it may even be immoral in its connotation. So I have here three examples for us to consider tonight. Here's the first word, the word dang. You ever use that word? You're not going to raise your hand tonight, are you? But do you ever know anybody that used that word? Yes. You ever know anybody that's a good Christian use that word? I have. They wouldn't curse. They would not curse. Godly people use the word dang. Well, here's some definitions for the word dang. Remember that bus? Let's see what passengers are up there on that bus. Got several seats there. Let's see who's riding the bus. Here's one. Express dissatisfaction or annoyance. That's one definition. That's one of those passengers over there. But over there on the other side, here's another passenger, to condemn someone to hell. Dang, which passenger got off? Which one did the guy who spoke put on the bus? Which one did he mean? If he meant, man, this is annoying, I can't figure this out, that's the guy he put on the bus. But on the other end, somebody, a friend, a brother, a family member, heard him use it, said, listen, that guy is cursing. And he claims to be a Christian. Misunderstanding. And if he goes around and tells people that guy cusses, that's misrepresentation. That's not judging righteous judgment. And so here's an example of that very word. Here's another definition. The least valuable bit. Oh, that other seat. There's another seat of that bus. Here's another one. The least valuable bit, a jot. So if a fellow says, well, I don't give a dang. What do you mean? I don't give a care for that. I'm not interested in that. Fellow starts talking about computers. My son in Dallas, he's a computer geek like some of these guys in this audience are. And he can start talking about computers in 10 seconds. I don't know what he's talking about. And so I change the conversation. You know why? I don't give a dang. I don't know what he's talking about, and I really don't care. I'm glad you got guys that know, so I can use the computer. But I'm not cussing. However, if I use that in some places without any explanation, guess what I'm going to be accused of? Profanity. That would be unjust. But there's an obligation on my part to try to be careful. So I try to avoid that word. I'm using it here tonight because I got you, and I can tell you what I mean by it. Don't you dare go away and say, I'm cussing now. I'm going to confront you. Okay? All right. Now, here's the second word we got. Here's damn. And that's a word we don't use. I grew up avoiding that word. And you go back and look at the history of the word damn. It's pretty interesting. On that bus, boy, there's an old guy. I mean, that guy's old. He gets off. Let's see what that passenger is. It comes from a French and Latin terms, and I'm reading from the Oxford English Dictionary. That's a pretty good source, right? And it says, it wasn't always an expletive. In other words, a cuss word, profanity. It wasn't always that. To damn, in about 1300 A.D., just meant to sentence them for a crime. So if you're a judge, guy's guilty. You're damned. That strikes us pretty strange, wouldn't it? Nothing immoral, ungodly. It's actually a carrying out of justice. But that's in 1300. And none of the connotation we often associate with it. By the late 16th century, it really didn't give the time when it actually changed, but it began to use in theological context with this idea of wishing somebody goes to hell for eternity. The way many of us have heard the word used, and we try to avoid it because of that connotation. And so, here's another definition, though. Expressing annoyance. Guy takes a hammer, hits his hand, hits his thumb, bam! And he comes out with this word. Is he trying to curse somebody? Send somebody to hell? Is he aggravated with somebody? No, he's aggravated situation. And when I was in Highlands, I spent 6 months staying with a guy, converted him out of the world. Well, his daily language was this kind of language. He didn't change it overnight. He had to work on it. But he would use words like this. You work with people that use the word damn. And maybe they don't mean one thing about hell. They don't even believe in hell. It's just an expletive of, man, this is aggravating. So if you go and chew that person's cussing. Now maybe they were wrong for using the word. They should have given it some thought. But guess who else is wrong? You don't want to be mischarging people. Judge, righteous judgment. And so, here's a word that we need to certainly be careful about. I'm certainly not encouraging the use of either dang or damn because there's just too many, a lot of old passengers on that bus that you may be associating with. And it's liable to leave a bad connotation. So I'm certain, and you young people in this audience, I want you to understand clearly I'm not encouraging the use of these words. I'm just dealing with the facts of the case, what etymology does and euphemisms does to meanings of words. You ever use the word gosh or golly? I have. Well, in its history, those words were a euphemism for God. And so, well-meaning brethren write, it's a sin for you to use the word gosh and golly. Really? Another definition, what it's come to mean, is nothing more than surprise or wonder. You go look it up for yourself. Somebody tells you something you never thought was true. Gosh. You make a mistake doing something. Golly. What they had to do with God? It had anything to do with God. Not respecting God. It's just a statement that expresses annoyance or surprise at what happened. And so, you know, there are other euphemisms for God. It was really interesting to me. Just before class, Elizabeth told me this. So I'm going to use her example. I've got a whole list of euphemisms for God here in my notes. But I'm going to use the one Elizabeth talked about. Let's see where here's my list. And they're just all kind of words. I tried to look up some of these, and some of these the dictionaries didn't even know that they were euphemisms for God, but be that as it may. Goodness, you ever say goodness? That was a euphemism for God. So if you're going to accuse the guy who says gosh and golly of using God's name in vain, you better go look in the mirror if you ever say goodness. How about gracious? Yeah, that was a euphemism for God. You can go look it up for yourself. 1300, filled with God's grace. And then it became elliptically for a gracious God from 1713. Great Scott. You ever say that? We use it as an exclamation of surprise. But according to what I found, that at one time it was Scott replaced the word God. Would it be fair to accuse somebody who used Great Scott of using God's name lightly? No. No, it wouldn't. So Elizabeth told me for years she had said, for Pete's sake. Oh, man, she found out that Mr. Pete had another connotation. That at one time that was for God's sake. Pete was put for God. Euphemism. Now, if you heard her say, for Pete's sake, you said, that Elizabeth, she's just not careful with her tongue. She uses God's name lightly. It's not, I'm appalled. You know who's in trouble, don't you? Not Elizabeth. It's you for defaming her character. So, if we work with the world, you know, work in world environments, if we take somebody out of the world and baptize them into Christ, maybe they use these kind of words, depending on the environment, depending on the culture. Different cultures, different words have different meanings. And so we've got to be very careful that we share in common what the person who said a word meant before we draw some judgments about whether or not they're godly or ungodly or in sin. Any comments or questions? Yes, sir.
Stephen, and normal vernacular of the world today, there's a lot of four-letter words that would never come out of my mouth. But people use some four-letter words, just as you described.
I agree with you. They're words I wouldn't use, but they don't mean anything spiritual or godly. And as Craig said, and I think it's a good practice, it's probably not something we ought to do. But for me then to charge them with profanity, that's something I ought not to do. Anybody? Thank you for being here and for your attention.